Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 11th of July. It is time for All Things Political, which you always hear on Mondays, and we have so much to talk about today. This morning, the Dallas Morning News had this as a front page editorial. Today, our country seems capable of pulling apart in ways that have not seemed possible in many decades. Dallas has been bathed again in blood and grief. How we respond will help show a path forward to a divided and reeling nation. What is the path forward? We will ask our guests that question, and he has done really wonderful political writing. Our guest is Josh Kroschauer. He's the political editor for National Journal and writes the weekly Against the Grain column. Prior to working at National Journal, he was a political correspondent for Politico. He reported on congressional campaigns and managed the Scorecard blog devoted to up-to-the-minute coverage of elections. He's appeared as a political analyst on TV and radio, Fox News, MSNBC, CNN, NPR, C-SPAN. He's written some interesting articles about the control of the Senate, which he has written will be decided in half a dozen swing states, and he outlines those contests very thoroughly. We'll be sure and talk about that. With running mate picks, will Clinton and Trump play it safe? We will be talking, of course, about the president and the vice president and former President George W. Bush being in Dallas tomorrow. We'll talk about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and some comments that she has made about Donald Trump and what she said about the Senate refusing to confirm or act, really, on President Obama's Supreme Court nominee. And that's just a little bit of what's on the table today. Our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And the Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, leave your comments there. We will read some of them. And Twitter, @KDunnShow. Josh, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, good to be on the show, Kathleen.
Yeah, good to have you here. I, you know, what a horrible time this is. We've got all of these shootings taking place, and I thought that the Dallas Morning News had a challenge for everybody, but I don't know politically how politicians running for office can meet this challenge, but we've got these shootings happening all the time, and now we've got two African-Americans being shot, then an African-American shooting and killing five police officers. You just throw up your hands and say, what the heck has happened to the country?
It's a very perilous time politically, Kathleen.
And isn't
just
it?
Look at the presidential race. And Hillary Clinton gave one speech in Philadelphia on Friday, addressing the issue to some African American leaders. Donald Trump stayed off the campaign trail, put out a video statement expressing his condolences and real worry about what's going on in the country. But you know, I study polling and the mood of the country, you know, on the political side, and it's remarkable how we've become so politically polarized by race. If you look over the last decade or so, I mean, white voters are increasingly supporting Republican candidates. You know, Mitt Romney, even though he lost the 2012 election, almost got a historic amount of support from white voters in the country. And Trump has maintained much of that support, even though he has serious problems with Hispanics, with African Americans, and other non-white voting groups. And you know, you're looking at the degree of polarization racially and how it's translated into reactions to these crises and these awful events that are going on, have gone on in the last week. So it's hard to find a middle. The middle has disappeared politically, and it is heartening to see, you know, for example, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich put out a comment saying he understands how African Americans feel and sounding a note of empathy during these very divisive times. But it's hard to find much of that center anymore in our politics and our conversations, and it reflects in this current presidential race.
And why are these issues of race raising their heads so angrily and tragically at this time in our history?
Well, part of it is our politics, but part of it is also how quickly we you know, react to information. I mean, we're in the midst of a social media revolution where anyone can videotape a crisis going on or react instantaneously. So people aren't even gathering facts. They're not even reporting before they have an instant take, an instant reaction, or they're resorting to their own talking points. And it's not just media, but the fact that you can communicate so fast in today's age, as opposed to a generation ago where it took further time for people to digest the news and react to it. And that's playing a major factor in our politics, where candidates feel like they have to react instantaneously, even if we don't know all the facts in a given situation.
And you just know that in the days ahead, everybody's stunned right now, but you know that all of these issues that are front and center are going to be played out politically, and I'm worried about that.
Well, what's interesting is how Trump decides to message the
yes.
issue of law and order during this week, and also coming up next week as the Cleveland convention approaches. It was very notable that he sort of, after Orlando, he really said some pretty divisive things in the wake of the terrorist attack at the gay nightclub in Orlando, and his advisors cautioned him this time around that you can't just shoot from the hip. You can't just tweet your way into responding to this crisis. And he put out a statement videotaped that his staff prepared, took a lot of time into coming up with a reaction that would be a more mainstream approach. But I mean, it's a very, very tenuous time in our politics. There are a lot of anxiety for security in both conventions, including the Republican convention in Cleveland. And the nation is on edge. You can just look at the degree of dissatisfaction that the public feels about the direction of the country.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk more about all of this a full hour, actually, tomorrow. Clarence Page is going to join us from the Chicago Tribune, and we'll look at what happened in Louisiana and Minnesota and Dallas for a full hour tomorrow. But Josh is also quite an expert on looking at political races. We'll start with Trump and Clinton, but he's written some very interesting things about the control of the Senate, so we'll move into that as we carry on here. When are we going to get running mate picks from Clinton and Trump, Josh? Do we know?
This week would be a good bet for Donald
really?
Trump to unveil his running mate, and it looks like it's come down to about four leading contenders. You've got former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, the current governor of Indiana, Mike Pence, and as a wild card, the former head of the DIA, who was ousted during the Obama administration, who's been a very big critic of the president's foreign policy, and Mike Flynn. And I think right now Pence looks like the front runner, but given that Trump is the person making the pick, I would not count on anything until he actually makes the announcement.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have written about the people who were the front runners until recently, Christie and Gingrich, and saying that they probably wouldn't do anything to shake up the race or change the nature of his insurgents' candidacy. Would Pence?
Now, Pence is the safest choice, and I'm actually a little surprised. If Trump does go with Mike Pence as his running mate, it suggests that the professionals are back in control of the Trump campaign, that he's picking a governor in Pence who is someone who appeals to all factions of the Republican Party, who is respected by most parts of the Republican Party, but doesn't excite anyone, and would be someone who is a pick you make when you're ahead, not when you're behind by 5 to 6 points like he is in the national poll. So Pence is a guy that Republicans can get behind. I'm not convinced that Trump's running mate selection is going to convince these anti-Trump Republicans that are not supporting him under any circumstances, whether just picking a mainstream Republican like Pence would change their minds, because they're ultimately looking at the number one at the ticket, not the number two.
When you talked about professionals being in control, are there professionals in control of the Trump campaign?
He's slowly staffing up, but this is not nearly as big, as well organized, or as well financed as a campaign that Hillary Clinton has been running for months now. And he's been trying to staff up. He hired a new communications director a couple weeks ago who worked in a similar role for Ted Cruz's presidential campaign. Paul Manafort is essentially the campaign manager who's making the key decisions. But this is still an insurgent-like organization for a man who's the Republican Party's nominee for president. This is unprecedented in recent presidential history.
And is there any kind of movement that has any strength at all to derail him at the convention? Trump, that is?
There is a faction of Republican delegates that are going to be meeting Thursday and Friday of this week to determine the rules for the nomination. And they think that they may have enough votes at least to present the broader pool of delegates with a vote to unbind the Republican delegates, to give them the option of voting for someone other than Trump, even if their state or district or precinct voted for him at the local level. So it's very unlikely. Republican leaders are not giving this faction of the party their blessing. And I think unless you have a Paul Ryan, a Mitch McConnell, a Reince Priebus coming out and saying we're going to pull the rug out from under Donald Trump, it's very hard to see how these movements will really have any success.
And for Hillary Clinton, her choice, a squeaky clean male version of Clinton, you write.
Tim Kaine is my reference there, the Virginia senator who is campaigning with Hillary Clinton in Northern Virginia on Thursday. So this could be a big week for both parties' running mate selections. Tim Kaine is about as clean, as respected a senator as you get in Washington, but he's also a very boring, safe type of pick. That makes more sense for Hillary Clinton to go in that direction than a Donald Trump, because Hillary Clinton is leading by 5 to 6 points. She has some fundamental advantages when you look at the polling breakdowns, and I don't think she wants to pick someone who could have some skeletons in their closet, who may be a little untested or young, not experienced enough for the job. And Tim Kaine seems to check all the important boxes. He's from one of the biggest swing states in the country, Virginia. He speaks fluent Spanish. He's Catholic. Being a white male in the Democratic Party these days means you're sort of an extinct species. And Tim Kaine provides some ability to get white male voters, perhaps on Clinton's side. So he's the odds-on favorite in my mind as Clinton nears her decision.
But you described him as boring. Doesn't she need somebody who's not boring?
Not when she's leading, and not when she seems to – not when people hate – I mean, if Clinton was trailing by several points, or if Republicans had some – if it was another nominee than Trump that was heading the Republican ticket, yeah, it would be a different calculation. But I think she views Trump as polarizing enough that she's going to win voters no matter who she picks. And Kaine gives her some governing capital. It means if she's elected, she'll have someone who can be a successful and effective liaison to Congress.
How does she overcome – well, she's got the email situation and then that lingering meeting between Loretta Lynch and her husband, Bill Clinton. The latest you write, NBC Wall Street Journal poll, 41-27% believe, that's amazing, 41-27 believe that Donald Trump is more honest and trustworthy than Hillary Clinton. That's saying something, you write. It is. What's it saying?
Well, isn't that remarkable?
Yes.
And it's not just the NBC Wall Street Journal poll. It's the general trend of all the national polls that shows voters believe Trump is more trustworthy and more honest than Hillary Clinton. And a lot of those polls were taken before FBI Director Comey came out with his findings from the email investigation. So she's got some serious vulnerabilities. And I maintain that if Republicans nominated anyone other than Donald Trump, they probably would have the advantage, or perhaps a large advantage, in this presidential race. But for the Republicans, they nominated the one candidate that actually has worse favorability numbers, worse approval ratings than Hillary Clinton.
So what's the latest now on the email situation? Who's investigating at this point? What did Comey's comments mean for her campaign? And, well, obviously didn't make her think, many Americans didn't think of her as more trustworthy as a result of what he said. But what are the lingering effects of that?
Well, the legal part of the investigation, the investigation itself is closed, but the political implications are long-lasting. And it's hard to see how Hillary Clinton can turn around, but at least before the election, can turn around these favorability numbers, these trustworthy numbers, given all the baggage that she's carrying. If she was running against Marco Rubio, if she was even running against Ted Cruz, it's easy to see how they could exploit this very effectively. But Donald Trump has his own problems with the truth, that he has his own lawsuits where he's being really hammered for his ethical practices as a businessman. So if you could find one Republican who actually has worse scores or worse opposition research on that front, it is Donald Trump.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you, and we're going to go to the Senate. Control of the Senate, Josh has written, will be decided in a half dozen swing states where Republican senators will be defending their records in an unusually volatile year. I think it's worth our while to look at those swing states, who's running and where things are right now. Where does Donald Trump factor into how well the state Senate or the national run for the national Senate are doing? And what about down ticket races, too? We'll look at all of that. And welcome your phone calls. We have a lot to talk about, including, the horrors that took place over the weekend in Dallas and in Louisiana and Minnesota over the weekend, protests, vigils, calls for peace. President Obama going to Dallas tomorrow. So is former President George W. Bush. They will be addressing a memorial service. We'll talk about that for a full hour tomorrow, but it certainly weaves its way into our political conversation this hour. Here's how you join our All Things Political for this Monday. You give us a call, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour for All Things Political is Josh Kroschauer. He is the political editor for National Journal, and we have a ton of phone calls coming in, and so let's start taking them. Tom in Appleton. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Tom.
Yeah, so I missed part of the program, so this might have been addressed, but I think you asked at the very outset, what is different? You know, and to me, one of the obvious things that is sometimes overlooked is that there's cameras everywhere, so things that used to not get picked up on are readily seen and spread around by the internet today. We had a chief of police in the city I live in issue a big editorial at a previous incident of possible police brutality, and he completely overlooked that and blamed everybody except the perpetrators. But there's cameras everywhere, and that's a huge change from even 5 years ago, let alone 10 or 20.
I think you're right about that, Josh.
Yeah, perception can often be reality, or at least feel like reality. But we were talking about that earlier in the show, and the New York Times actually published a landmark study in today's paper about how actually there is a disparity when it comes to policing of African Americans and white Americans when it comes to lower level crimes. But when it comes to violent crimes, there's actually not a disparity. So it was a really counterintuitive type of analysis that this lengthy study demonstrated, and it goes to show that our instant reactions to what we see in the media, what we see on our social media feeds, can sometimes skew the reality of what's happening on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Ann in Milwaukee. Hi, Ann.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question for your guest. Maureen Dowd's column talked about the Clinton contamination of people like Comey, Loretta Lynch, Uma Abedin, and so on, of people who otherwise had a sterling reputation who now have this kind of shadow over them because of the things that have come out about Clinton. And I was wondering if your guest could talk about the fact that, in my opinion, the New York Times now has a similar shadow over it, given its pushing of Hillary during this entire campaign, Paul Krugman in particular, but other pieces in the New York Times. And now I'm wondering if belatedly they feel like they maybe should have looked a little more at her character and also her political behavior.
Yeah. Well, Dowd has been pretty hard on Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump and everybody, but it was a pretty harsh column yesterday.
Yeah, I wouldn't. It was a tough column by Maureen Dowd, but I wouldn't let some of the Obama administration officials off the hook either. I mean, it was Attorney General Lynch's decision to have a 30-minute conversation with the former president in the middle of an investigation, and President Obama also made statements during numerous interviews, essentially leaning towards exonerating Clinton, even though the investigation was also still going on. So I don't think you can just blame Hillary Clinton for all the misdeeds or the problems that some people in the Obama administration have had.
Do you think, you've written about this too, the President Trump's rise to great visibility and popularity. What do you think about the treatment of campaigns so far? We're getting fairly close to November now. Do you think that we've had a real full-fledged investigation of the issues and discussion of the issues? Seems to me as though it hasn't really been that way so far, and Trump has had a whole lot of airtime.
No, but then again, when have issues taken center stage, even in other recent presidential campaigns? It's been about personalities, and Donald Trump's personality hovers above all. And Hillary Clinton's own personal scandals and problems have also dominated the coverage of her as well over the issues that Americans face. But, you know, it's different. The media coverage is different when you're facing a 17-candidate primary, and one of those 17 candidates is a celebrity who's been on television before and is this curiosity that, unlike any other. And for someone who had lacked such political credibility but got all the attention that he did in this crowded primary, gave him enormous advantages over the other challengers. But now that he's running against one candidate, essentially, Hillary Clinton, it's much easier to provide balanced coverage to give both candidates the scrutiny that they deserve. It really, the disparity really showed itself, though, in the primary, when serious candidates like Marco Rubio and John Kasich, among others, just got little attention while Donald Trump was dominating the airwaves.
Mm-hmm. What did you make of Sam Tannenhaus's article in the New York Times yesterday looking at Donald Trump as maybe being, in a way, a savior for the Republican Party because he is not a down-the-line conservative? He's breaking the hold that Republican conservative elites may have on the party and addressing issues that a lot of Republican voters care about, the economy and trade, et cetera. He doesn't have a traditional conservative viewpoint on that, but he may change the direction of the Republican Party in a good way.
There's something to be said for that argument, but then again, we're talking about Trump and not a generic Republican running on issues that are sort of heterodox to the party elite and the party leadership. And if anything, I think he's actually damaging if he loses the general election badly to Hillary Clinton, it's going to damage the party's ability to relate to those voters because they'll probably move back into the traditional direction that they've always the issues that they've always stood for. So I do see there was always an opening for a candidate to run against free trade, a candidate to run against liberalized immigration policies. That was always there. Jim Webb, in fact, probably could have run in the Republican Party primary and had similar opportunities. But Trump, because of his celebrity, because of his just ability to get attention, often makes these issues about something else. You know, he doesn't deal with the facts or the policies. He'll nod to where people are feeling about what people are feeling about an issue, but he'll actually hurt the cause more than it should be.
And Josh, where does the thing stand now? Does it look like that he may lose the general election or not?
Well, Trump has a floor, and I think he has a ceiling. And you can see in some of these polls that he's getting 40% of the vote. The base is with him, no matter what. But it's hard to see, given his unpopularity numbers with women, with college-educated voters, with non-white voters, it's really hard to see how he can get to a plurality or a majority of the vote. It's going to be a competitive election. We're not going to be seeing a McGovern-Goldwater-style, 49-state landslide. But it's hard to see how he can win some of the states that Obama carried in 2008 and 2012.
And thanks for your call. Let's go to Reed in Clintonville. Hello, Reed.
Good afternoon. Say two things. First, I have never heard the vitriol, the hatred, the incitement to violence, the racism or sexism of any sort coming from Hillary and as I have from Mr. Trump. Secondly, I just read this morning that Hillary actually applied for, and there's documented proof evidently, that Hillary applied for secure server or secure BlackBerry type phone, the same type that the president uses, and applied through channels in the federal government and was denied that, and evidently applied several times, requested several times, and was denied several times. So consequently, she set up something of her own. And I'll just hang up and listen to
the
comments.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, I'm unaware of those. I don't think that was mentioned in FBI Director Comey's report. But even if that was true, it doesn't give the Secretary of State license to regardless of what was determined, to go ahead and use her own private email server, where those emails that she sent wouldn't be captured by the government. And so far as there be no moral equivalence between what Trump and Clinton said, yeah, I agree. And that's why Trump has the unfavorability ratings that he does. People, even on the Republican side, view what he has said outside the mainstream, outside of what's acceptable to them. And that's why Clinton, despite all her baggage, maintains a solid lead in this presidential race.
Nancy is next in Madison. Hi.
Hi. I think there is one thing talked about that I have not heard hardly anyone speak to, and that is the accountability for the African-American individual and culture. And I think sometimes people say, boy, that's a hard thing to talk about. Just as an FYI, I have a black daughter and a biracial daughter. I care deeply about this culture. But, for example, I think in Milwaukee, on a day when there was a protest of thousands of people about a police shooting, at that same day there were several drive-by shootings. what can we do to get the African-American leadership to say, this is not okay. People have to start being different.
Well, we sure have had a whole lot of shootings, haven't we, Josh?
Yeah, I mean, it is depressing when you look at cities like Chicago, and the crime rate is up in some of the major American cities. It is very depressing, and there are no easy answers. And that's why I think our political leadership has been so unable to handle what's been happening. Now, even President Obama seems to be sort of helpless when he reacts to what becomes so regular in our social fabric. So, I don't think there are any easy answers, and it would be great if we could even have that dialogue, that cross-partisan dialogue, to even have these types of conversations, which seem to be so absent from what we see on television and radio.
Yeah, and there was some criticism of the police in Dallas for saying these people are suspects and their faces were on television. And yet, as the president said, and this is, I wonder if this conversation will go anywhere. President Obama said one of the challenges for the Dallas officers who were being shot is that Texas is an open carry state. Imagine you're a police officer and you're trying to sort out who's shooting at you, and there are a bunch of people who have got guns on them and they're carrying them perfectly legally, right?
Texas does have very liberal gun laws, and that's obviously an issue that Democrats have been trying to bring to the forefront. And that's one of the issues that we have politically, is that even Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives, can't even agree what's the main reason for a lot of these mass shootings or terrorist attacks. And after the Orlando terrorist attack, Democrats leapt to use guns as a major issue and tried to hammer Republicans over the head with it, whereas Republicans wanted tighter and tougher laws against anti-terrorism laws. So, I mean, you don't even agree when you look at the top issues that Democrats feel and Republicans feel in all the national polls. They're almost entirely at odds with each other. Republicans rank national security as their number one issue in most polls. Democrats rank climate change and health care much higher than Republicans do. So it's and guns, obviously, up there as well. So we can't even agree on the issues that are important as a country.
I think that we all agree, Josh, and I don't know who accomplishes this, but you can't have week after week with all of these horrendous shootings. You just can't live in a country like that. People just get a feeling of helplessness.
Absolutely. Though it is important to note that, you look at the gun crime rate and the murder rate of the country right now as compared to even, 15 years ago. It's much lower than it was. And like I said at the outset of the show, sometimes the media nonstop coverage of some of these high-profile events makes it seem like we're in this really awful period of time. And I think politically speaking, we are. We've never been more polarized as a country than we have in quite some time. But when you actually look at the statistics of gun violence and murders, we're actually near all-time lows, or at least recent lows in those areas. So it is important to put that degree of context into the situation.
Let's go to Janika. Is it on the road? Hi, Janika.
Yeah, hi, it's Janika.
Janika, hi, Janika.
Yeah, hello to both of you. I'm going to piggyback on the last two callers to hopefully make a clear point. I was struck by both of the callers' sense of humanity and understanding of why Black Lives matters, and listening to talking political heads sometimes who are in dismay at the polarization of our country. There's a lot of us citizens, and I live in Madison, who are not so much in dismay but in frustration that the media is not talking with in more direct ways or a greater understanding of why there is so much rage in the Black communities. I think if our school history programs were to teach the real history of our country, if people would talk more about how things came to be, how Black people feel in this country as ostracized as they do, I think there would be a greater, gentleness of the people in general toward the difficulties that are happening now. To me, they make all the sense in the world. If I were Black, I would be feeling the same way. And when you talk about politics in the sense of, everything is so divisive and, nobody trusts Donald Trump and nobody trusts Hillary Clinton, you are ignoring those of us out here who have found a candidate to trust. And I think that maybe you need a female talking head in to talk politics who could explain, I'm going on to another point here, but who could explain how important Hillary Clinton is to all of us out here who are minorities, who are women minorities. And that point gets ignored, I find, very often. But there's a lot of women and other people out here sitting contented that we finally have a voice.
Thanks, Janica, very much for your call. And we will have more and have had many female political analysts on the program. All right. Do you want to respond to that, Josh?
I mean, it sounds like she's a Hillary Clinton supporter, so it's understandable that there's some degree of frustration given the news. But, I mean, it's a political reality. I mean, this is not something that's coming out of thin air. But, you know, you look on questions about racial views and you look at questions about political views, and we haven't been as divided politically and racially as we have in quite some time.
Right. So what about the president? What about our first African-American president? The importance of what he will say tomorrow in Dallas and the importance of what he may say and needs to say further to address the very issues that we're contemplating today.
Well, this is an important moment for the White House, and it's a rare moment given that you have former President Bush and President Obama appearing on the same stage, giving remarks back-to-back to each other. It's a real opportunity to really heal a lot of the wounds that the public felt after the Dallas shootings, the police shootings. The question is, can kind of Obama in the final months of his presidency live up to the occasion? Mm-hmm. So often he's given a very strong speech, but he's failed to really unite. I mean, he's comes from a a tradition and a viewpoint that is to the left of probably a lot of Republicans and a lot of independents, and he's always by focusing on guns and by focusing on some of the issues that he cares about, he hasn't lived up to the opportunity to kind of move to the middle and try to find some areas of agreement, some areas where the public can unite. And I think this is an opportunity for him. It's a chance as he tries to look towards his legacy upon leaving the presidency to really get something done in the final months of his presidency.
How do you move to the middle? What's the middle on all of this, Josh?
Well, one example I've written about and talked about is, after the Orlando terrorist attack, say that you're going to you're going to support legislation where you support some degree of gun control, but you also provide some measures against like Silicon Valley companies to crack down on some of the hate speech and terrorist fomenting on sites like Facebook, Twitter, and so on. Mm-hmm. Throw a bone to the Republicans and acknowledge that it's terrorism, that Islamic terrorism that's really driving a lot of the these horrible incidents, and also try to have a package where you can get some of your favorite issues, and you get some things that Republicans are supportive of too. That's how politics used to be done. You have a disagreement. You've always had disagreement across the aisle, but you would find areas of agreement, and maybe Republicans would offer a concession in one place, and Democrats would offer a concession somewhere else. But we haven't seen any of that on either side of the aisle since Obama became president.
Mm-hmm. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and you're listening to All Things Political. We're welcoming phone calls. You can also go to our Facebook page where we will be happy to read some comments, and that is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Let's get to those Senate races because you really have examined these so fully, and I thank you for doing so. Control of the Senate, you wrote, I can't remember how long ago you wrote it, Josh, but it will be decided in half a dozen swing states where Republican senators will be defending their records in an unusually volatile year. So give us the skinny on those states, please.
To watch Ohio, where Senator Rob Portman is going to be facing the former governor of Ohio and Ted Strickland. The other big race to watch, I would say, is Pennsylvania, where Pat Toomey, a freshman senator with a lot of money and in a blue state like Pennsylvania, is running against Katie McGinty, who is one of the Democratic Party's top challengers. And you also have a big rig race in Florida, where Marco Rubio decided, after saying he was not going to run for the Senate for a second term, changed his mind and is running against a Democratic congressman from Palm Beach by the name of Patrick Murphy. But those are the three. If you have to look at three races to see which party is going to be in control of the Senate in November, I would say Pennsylvania, Florida, and Ohio.
What about John McCain?
That's a fascinating race. And if there's a race that Trump's presidential candidacy puts on the map for Democrats, it is Arizona. And McCain is actually polling, if you talk to Democrats there, that he's seriously vulnerable. He's barely polling ahead of his Democratic challenger, Ann Kirkpatrick. And because Trump threatens to engage Hispanic voters to vote and register in a way that they haven't in the past, the demographics of Arizona pose a serious threat to John McCain, but they pose a threat to Donald Trump. Arizona's been a solidly Republican state. Hasn't voted for a Democrat for president in a couple decades, and Trump is putting that state in play in the presidential race.
Let's go to Ed in West Dallas next. Hi, Ed.
Well, this is what I wanted to talk about today: these Senate races, because I think you have to include the race between Feingold and the Republican here in Wisconsin as also being in play. What are the in the states that you mentioned, what's the split in terms of the percentage right now between the candidates, and will, if the Democrats take control of the Senate, does that make the lame duck session better for Obama's nominee to the Supreme Court to get confirmed?
So to the last question, yes. If Democrats retake the Senate, I'd be shocked if Republicans didn't try to hold a lame duck confirmation hearing for Merrick Garland, Obama's Supreme Court nominee. As far as the math for the Senate, I mean, Democrats need to, if Hillary Clinton becomes president, Democrats need to win 4 Senate seats. The reason I didn't mention Wisconsin is that if they retake the Senate, Wisconsin is going to be part of that 4 seat parlay. You know, they need to win Wisconsin. If they lose Wisconsin, if Russ Feingold doesn't win the race against Ron Johnson, it's hard to see how Democrats will retake the Senate. It's one of their Democratic Party's best pickup opportunities. So Ron Johnson is several points behind. It's still a competitive race, and there's going to be quite a bit of money poured into Wisconsin over the next several months. The big states that are sort of on that bubble that could go either way that will determine control of the Senate are more likely going to be those classic swing states, Ohio, Florida, and Pennsylvania, which is trending a little more Republican than we've seen in some time.
What do you make of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's comments all over the press today, really anti-Trump? I can't imagine what the country would be with Donald Trump as our president. She talks about 4 years for the country, but 4 years for the court, she says. I don't even want to contemplate that. Now, she said, is the time for us to move to New Zealand, which is something that her husband evidently said when he was upset politically. That's pretty amazing for her to be so outspoken, isn't it?
Pretty unprecedented for a sitting Supreme Court justice to engage in partisan politics in such an open manner. I think it means two things, Kathleen. I think it means that she's probably looking at an early retirement, probably after the next presidential election, especially if Hillary Clinton wins the presidency. And I also think that she'd have to recuse herself. If there was any legal battle over, like we saw with Bush and Gore, if there was a legal battle between Trump and Clinton, if this election really came down to some hanging chads in Wisconsin, I think she'd probably have to recuse herself from the decision. It could have a very serious impact in that situation. So in a 4-4 court. So yeah, I mean, this is pretty unprecedented stuff.
Please, no hanging chads in Wisconsin. Please, that would be horrible.
Waukesha County
right.
Counts or something.
Right. You're listening to All Things Political. Our guest this hour is Josh Krashauer, and he is political editor for National Journal. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls. And to Ron in Choma is next. Hi, Ron.
Hi there.
Hi.
I got into your program late, so I didn't hear any of the much of the other commentary.
Okay.
In relation to what Black Lives Matter and a lot of other...
Can't hear you, Ron. Hello. Well, that phone just kind of disappeared. Claire in Madison, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you.
Sure.
I'm going to say something very harsh today, Kathleen. I honestly think that many Republicans were secretly rubbing their hands in glee when the shootings happened in Dallas. And I'll tell you why I say that. The big true issue in this nation is oppression. And as long as we little people are all fighting amongst ourselves, it's just a big distraction from the true problem in this country against women, against blacks, against Hispanics, Muslims, you name it, American natives. And they don't want to change any gun laws in any little tiny way. They're in the back pocket of the NRA, and shame on Paul Ryan for not even allowing a vote. They're a bunch of hypocrites, and they don't really care about little people.
All right, Josh, let you handle that one.
Well, thanks, Kathleen. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the caller is a demonstration of just how, like, this is an example of how polarized this country has become when the caller says that Republicans were rooting for excited that five police officers were murdered. I don't know a single Republican who feels that way, but clearly, like, the caller believes that we're so disconnected from what's going on in the country that neither side can understand each other.
I don't know what we do about that. I mean, it's been building for quite some time, but I don't know how you can govern a country with this kind of atmosphere. What breaks it, Josh?
Well, normally the presidential election provides a reset, a new leader, a new CEO, if you will. The president sets the tone for the how people feel and for the mood of the country. It's hard, though, to see with two of the most polarizing figures to run for president that it's going to change. I will say the one thing, at least on Hillary Clinton's behalf, is that when she was in the Senate and even when she served as Secretary of State, her favorable numbers were quite solid. And when she's had a chance, this is the case that her campaign makes. So that when she has a chance to govern, she actually does have a good relationship with Republicans. She actually does, and John McCain and her had famous drinking games on foreign policy codels when they served in the Senate together. She's someone who, more Obama's a very distant president, does not like negotiating or dealing with Congress, whereas Hillary Clinton actually enjoys the game. She enjoys the politics of negotiating and compromise. So I mean, Trump is another figure entirely, and I don't think we know how he would govern, but Clinton does have a record of reaching across the aisle, of having a bipartisan relationship. So if she does get elected, and presidents do have this so-called 100-day honeymoon period where, you know, it's easier to get things done, it's easier to kind of use political capital to your advantage. The one glimmer of hope, I would say, is that there is an opportunity, given Clinton's history, that she would try and would need to really build relationships with Republicans to get reelected in another 4 years.
Well, Trump would have to meet over coffee because he doesn't drink, does he?
He does not. And Trump is an entirely different type of negotiator. I really think Trump is a blank slate, and the only guidance we have towards how he would govern is how he's talked and how he's campaigned as a Republican presidential candidate.
We talked about the Senate races. We didn't talk about down ticket and the effect that Trump is having on those races, at least at this point in time.
It's a very worrisome time to be a Senate Republican or a House Republican. And the good news for Republicans is that this fear of a total wave election that Trump would totally destroy Republican candidates' chances is not shaping up to be the case. It's more of an unpredictable, uncertain atmosphere for Republican candidates. And the problem is Trump actually has a very loyal base of support, and sometimes he wins support from untraditional working-class voters that may not have been loyal Republicans or solid Republican down-ballot voters. So when you look at the polling for the big Senate races, a lot of the key races are tied within the margin of error. Trump is not damaging their prospects as much as I might have thought a month or two ago. But the problem is, do Republicans show up if they don't want to vote for Trump? Does he say something in the next few months that could really alienate Republicans and prevent them from voting down ballot?
Well,
who knows?
How much do we know about the extent of the anti-Trump feeling among Republicans?
We know that the party is essentially split in half, and if you look at the polls that ask whether, you know, you want Trump as the nominee, you'd rather have someone else, it's pretty much 50-50, and that's the dilemma that Republican leaders face, because if they went to the extreme measure of trying to unbind delegates and getting them to replace Trump at the convention, you'd have half the party that would be really angry, and that's why Mitch McConnell, that's why Paul Ryan have gone to such great lengths to defend Trump and his nomination, whereas distancing themselves, where they've been also distancing themselves from the comments he's been making, they worry that if they pulled the rug out from under Trump, you would have a kind of a confused leadership, and you'd also have a lot of angry Trump voters that aren't going to show up at all in November.
So instead you have this weird arrangement between people like Ryan and McConnell and Trump. They're kind of, well, you know, he did, he gave a tremendous speech when he met with all of us, and then he denounced what he had to say on any number of issues. It is a very unusual thing to watch, isn't it? He's going to be the nominee of the Republican Party, for heaven's sake.
It's extremely awkward, and I think there's a lot of denial, frankly, going on, at least in the among Republican leadership. But there is also some political calculation. The calculation that folks like Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, have decided is that there are really two parties within the Republican Party right now, and you have to keep them uncomfortably together, because if you blow it up, the consequences are going to be much more severe for the party. And then there's some logic to that. And when you see Republicans like Rob Portman or Republicans even like Ron Johnson still running competitively in these swing blue-leaning states, it does show that if you can keep this party together, however uncomfortably as it may be, they may be able to preserve the control of the Senate.
Let's go to Ned next. Hi, Ned. Go ahead,
hello?
Ned. Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yeah, one of the things we got to do is make sure that we don't just let Donald Trump off the hook by saying he's not going to release his tax returns. He has to, and the reason he's not showing them is that he's got a lot to hide, and he pays an unusually, most likely, a very small percentage of his huge income in taxes. We've simply got to have a drumbeat that continues to demand that every single presidential candidate has done for the last 30 years continues. We've got to see the tax returns.
Josh.
Well, I think that's the view of the public, but the challenge is that the ethical issues that Clinton and Trump both face. With Clinton, it's the email server. With Trump, it's Trump University and not releasing his taxes. They kind of neutralize each other. And even though Trump, when we were talking about how Trump has actually a lead when it comes to honesty and trustworthiness, which is sort of hard to believe, but it really, in the big picture, both of the weaknesses that Clinton and Trump bring to the table essentially neutralize each other out. Trump can't really use Clinton's email server as effectively as another Republican can because of his own baggage. Whereas Clinton, you know, whenever she goes on the attack about Trump University, Trump can come back at her with her own email server. So the ethical issues for both candidates are pretty severe, and both of them neutralize each other, politically speaking.
Mm-hmm. So what I almost hesitate to ask, because you want some sense of peace and reconciliation and bipartisanship, what will you be covering politically that maybe we'll help achieve that this week, or we'll keep that from happening, Josh?
Well, I will be in Cleveland at the Republican convention next week, and
oh,
I think
gosh.
The big story is going to be whether the party can unite, however uncomfortably. And the running mate selection that Trump makes is going to play a big role in that calculation. And whether the leadership gives its blessing or even looks the other way as certain delegates try to unbind themselves from voting for Trump. That's going to be the big story in the coming days. And it will tell us a long way about how this election will go.
Are there enough people to speak at the convention? Walker is, what? Cruz is, who else is?
And Paul Ryan decided after some hesitation today that he is going
to
be speaking as well. So Cruz and Ryan were sort of welcome developments for Trump. Maybe there'll be some sports stars, as Trump once suggested, but I think there will be enough elected officials. There are enough pro-Trump Republicans, or at least Republicans that have supported Trump, that are going to be there to speak in prime time.
It's going to be a very unusual convention, isn't it, Josh?
It, at least in my memory, and this is going to be the eighth convention, the eighth cycle, I've been through. This is certainly one of the most unique and unprecedented conventions I've ever covered.
Yeah. Thank you ever so much for being with us. Please join us again. We'll have more of a focus on Senate races and down ticket races with you. But thank you. Enjoyed the hour. Thanks.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Josh Krashauer, political editor for National Journal, our guest for All Things Political. We do want to tell you, because we could easily talk about what happened in Minnesota and in Louisiana and in Dallas for the whole hour, and so we are devoting the first hour tomorrow to a discussion of all of the issues that have unfolded in the wake of all of the shootings. Chicago Tribune columnist Clarence Page, who's been a guest with us many, many times and is a wonderful writer and thinker, will be with us for the full hour tomorrow to talk about all of that. Thanks very much for your questions and for listening. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this program, and thanks to Kiri Salinas for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We do want to tell you that we have an interesting hour coming up next hour, asking about whether or not there are too many liberals who are dominating the faculties of colleges all over the country. There have been calls to hire more conservative professors, maybe even through affirmative action, an issue that I'm sure will generate more than a few phone calls and some thoughts. We welcome them from you. So that conversation is coming up. The second hour of our program on this hot summer Monday afternoon.